A very stable genius. Donald J. Trump's Testing of America by Philip Rucker and Carol Lenig. Read for you by Hillary Huber.
This is Carol Lenig. Author's note. Reporting on Donald Trump's presidency has been a dizzying journey. Stories fly by every hour, every day. With each momentous event we chronicled, we realized history was unfolding in front of our eyes, and we had little chance to take stock. There was always something next. So we decided to hit the pause button. We wanted to drill down deeper than our daily news reporting allowed, to truly understand what was happening behind the scenes, and to assess the reverberations for the country. This book is based on hundreds of hours of interviews with more than 200 sources, including Trump administration officials, friends, and outside advisors to the president, as well as other witnesses to the events described herein. Most of the people who cooperated with our project agreed to speak candidly only on the condition of anonymity, either to protect their careers in the government or because they feared retaliation from the president or his allies. Many of our sources recounted their experiences in a background capacity, meaning we were permitted to use the information they shared so long as we protected their identities and did not attribute details to them by name. We recorded many of our interviews. We are objective journalists who seek to share the truth with the public. In this book, we aim to provide the closest version of the truth that we could determine based on rigorous reporting. We carefully reconstructed scenes to reveal President Trump unfiltered, showing him in action rather than telling readers what to think of him. These scenes are based on firsthand accounts and, whenever possible, corroborated by multiple sources and buttressed by our review of calendars, diary entries, internal memos, and other correspondence among principals, as well as private video recordings. Dialogue cannot always be exact, but is based here on multiple people's memories of events and, in many cases, contemporaneous notes taken by witnesses. In a few instances, sources disagreed substantively about the facts in an episode, and when necessary, we note that in these pages, recognizing that different narrators sometimes remember events differently. This book is an outgrowth of our reporting for the Washington Post. As such, some of the details in our narrative first appeared in stories we authored for the newspaper, some of them in collaboration with other colleagues. However, the vast majority of the scenes, dialogue, and quotations are original to our book and based on the extensive reporting we conducted exclusively for this project. To reconstruct episodes that played out in public, we relied upon video of events, such as presidential speeches, many of which are archived on C-SPAN's website. We also relied on contemporaneous news reports in an array of publications. We have also drawn from the government record, including the report produced by Special Counsel Robert S. Mueller III, and in most instances built upon the published record with our own original reporting. Material gleaned from such accounts is properly attributed with a direct reference either in the text or in the endnotes. We sought to interview President Trump for this project and first approached him in the early stages of our reporting. In a phone call, Trump told Philip Rucker he would like to sit for an interview. "Come in, you'll do a fair one," Trump said. The president added, "I'll do it, I'll do it, I'll do it. I'd like to have a proper book done. You're a serious person, so that's good." In later months, as Trump escalated his war with the media, he declined through an aide the opportunity to sit for an interview and to provide his own recollection and context for events described in this book. After several weeks of back-and-forth discussions, Trump's spokespeople were unable to substantively answer questions about those events or to provide the president's responses before the deadline for publication.
This is Philip Rucker. Prologue. quote, "I alone can fix it," end quote. On July 21, 2016, as he accepted the Republican presidential nomination in Cleveland, Donald John Trump spoke more than 4,000 words, but these five would soon become the tenet by which he would lead the nation. That night, Trump stood by himself at the center of Quicken Loans Arena on an elevated stage, which he had helped to design. A massive screen framed in gold soared behind him, projecting a magnified picture of himself along with 36 American flags. This was a masculine LED manifestation of his own self-image. His speech was dark and dystopian. He offered himself to the American people as their sole hope for renewal and redemption. Past presidential nominees had expressed humility, extolled shared values, and summoned their countrymen to unite to accomplish what they could only achieve together. But Trump spoke instead of I. Quote, "I am your voice," end quote. Quote, "I will be a champion, your champion," end quote. Quote, "Nobody knows the system better than me, which is why I alone can fix it," end quote. It would be all too easy to mistake Trump's first term for pure, uninhibited chaos. His presidency would be powered by solipsism. From the moment Trump swore an oath to defend the Constitution and commit to serve the nation, he governed largely to protect and promote himself. Yet while he lived day to day, struggling to survive, surfing news cycles to stay afloat, there was a pattern and meaning to the disorder. Trump's North Star was the perpetuation of his own power, even when it meant imperiling our shaky democracy. Public trust in American government, already weakened through years of polarizing political dysfunction, took a body blow. Tens of millions of Americans were angry, feeling forgotten by bureaucrats in Washington, derided by liberal elites, and humiliated by a global economy that had sped ahead of their skills and consigned their children to be the first American generation to fare less well than their parents. Trump crowned himself their champion. He promised them he would, quote, "make America great again," end quote, a brilliant, one-size-fits-all mantra through which this segment of the country could channel their frustrations. They envisioned an America in which regulations didn't strangle the family business, taxes weren't so onerous, and good-paying jobs were plentiful and secure. Some of them also harked back to the 1950s, envisioning a simpler America in which white male patriarchs ruled the roost, decorous women kept home and hearth, and minorities were silent or subservient. President Trump was the indefatigable pugilist for MAGA Nation. He did not bother with carefully selecting a group of leaders to help him govern. The flashy promoter and reality television star believed he could run the U.S. government the way he led his real estate development company from a corner suite on the 26th floor of Trump Tower, on his own gut instincts to seize opportunities and to size up and cut down competitors. Yet Trump's own recklessness hampered his ability to accomplish the very pledges on which he campaigned. From the start, government novices and yes-men made up much of his inner circle, a collective inexperience that exacerbated the troubles, wasted political capital, and demoralized committed public servants. The universal value of the Trump administration was loyalty, loyalty not to the country, but to the president himself. Some of his aides believed his demand for blind fealty and his retaliation against those who denied it was slowly corrupting public service and testing democracy itself. Two kinds of people went to work for the administration: those who thought Trump was saving the world and those who thought the world needed to be saved from Trump. The latter, who at times were drawn in by Trump's charm, were seasoned and capable professionals who felt a duty to lend him their erudition and expertise. Yet as the months clicked by, the president wore down these adults in the room with what they considered the inanity, impropriety, and illegality of his ideas and directives. One by one, these men and women either resigned in frustration or were summarily dismissed by Trump. He engaged in a constant cycle of betrayal, rupturing and repairing relationships anew to constantly keep his government aides off balance to ensure the continuity of his supremacy. Some of them now sigh from a distance at a president they hoped to guide and the realization that fewer voices of wisdom remain to temper his impulses. They lament a president who nursed petty grievances, was addicted to watching cable television news coverage of himself, elevated sycophants, and lied with abandon. Trump has delivered in part on his promise to be a human hand grenade, to raise and remake Washington. He has weakened the regulatory state, toughened border enforcement, and refashioned the federal judiciary, including with two nominations to the Supreme Court, all priorities for his conservative political base. Trump also transformed America's trade posture, weakening multilateral agreements which he believed allowed smaller countries to take advantage of the United States, and forging new bilateral accords on more favorable terms. He inherited a growing economy from President Obama and kept it humming, even as economists in mid-2019 predicted an eventual downturn. As Trump often reminded his critics, he has been a president like no other. He has challenged the rule of law and jolted foreign alliances, disregarding 70 years of relations with other democracies while encouraging dictators and despots. He questioned the nation's very identity as a diverse haven for people of all races and creeds by not silencing the white supremacists and bigots among his followers, and, occasionally, by employing racist rhetoric of his own. He treated subordinates and military officers with malice and detained migrant families. He broke boundaries for reasons significant and picayune, nefarious and innocuous. For this president, all that mattered was winning. Trump's ego prevented him from making sound, well-informed judgments. He stepped into the presidency so certain that his knowledge was the most complete and his facts supreme that he turned away the expertise of career professionals upon whom previous presidents had relied. This amounted to a wholesale rejection of America's model of governing, which some of his advisors concluded was born of deep insecurity. Quote, "Instead of his pride being built on making a good decision, it's built on knowing the right answer from the onset," end quote, a senior administration official said. When Trump's own intelligence analysts presented him with facts, the president at times claimed conspiracies. He refused to fully acknowledge that Russia had tried to help him win the 2016 election, despite conclusive evidence. He sought to thwart the Justice Department's investigation of Russia's election interference, and, after Robert Mueller was appointed special counsel, tried to have him removed. Yet Trump escaped being accused of a crime, despite scores of federal prosecutors who believed he would have faced criminal charges if he were anyone other than a sitting president. These are conclusions drawn from nearly 3 years of reporting about Trump's presidency. They reflect the experiences and opinions of several of the most senior principals who served in his administration, lived its dysfunction, and now fear the damage it is inflicting on the country they served. They took us for the first time inside some of the most controversial and defining moments of Trump's presidency. In a way, never before has an American president been as accessible and transparent as Trump. He telegraphed his moods and aired his disagreements in daily, sometimes hourly, posts on Twitter. Behind the scenes, revelations of tumult and lawlessness spilled forth daily. Whistleblowers stood up in dark corners of the federal bureaucracy to bring light to corruption and malfeasance. The president's state of mind was obvious to anyone, but the greater and perhaps more shocking meaning of the events of Trump's first term, beyond the daily news cycle, has not yet been made clear. Quote, "I've served the man for 2 years. I think he's a long-term and immediate danger to the country," end quote, a senior national security official told us. Another senior administration official said, quote, "The guy is completely crazy. The story of Trump, a president with horrible instincts and a senior-level cabinet playing whack-a-mole," end quote. Most of the officials who spoke with us did so on the condition of anonymity to avoid retribution from Trump and his team or because they felt honor-bound not to publicly criticize a sitting president. Sometimes government officials decide to cooperate with book authors to settle scores or generate a political outcome, and certainly some of our sources fall into this category. However, we found that many of them were motivated to tell the truth for the benefit of history. Some wanted to accurately explain moments that had been contorted by the president and his handlers' spin, easily forgotten, or, in some cases, kept entirely secret until now. Trump's defenders said those who fear his presidency have it all wrong. What others saw as recklessness, they saw as the courage to make decisions. They pointed out that every night on television, the president's critics decried the end of democracy as we know it, but the sun still rose the next morning. There are no perfect heroes in our book. Robert Mueller, perhaps Trump's greatest antagonist, was a faultless paragon of integrity from his days as a platoon commander in Vietnam to his directorship of the FBI, but emerged from 2 years of shadow boxing with Trump with scratches. In the estimation of many fellow prosecutors, he got outfoxed. World leaders, meanwhile, were ever adjusting to react to Trump's whims. Allies had little faith in what U.S. diplomats said because they could be overruled by a presidential tweet at a moment's notice. Foreign presidents and prime ministers were terrified about what Trump might plunge into in the name of America First. Quote, "This guy is the most powerful man on earth," end quote, said Gerard Araud, France's ambassador to the United States for the first 2 years of Trump's presidency. Quote, "Everything he does and decides may have very, very dire consequences on us, so we are all in a mode of damage control," end quote. Ahead of Trump's first major summit with foreign counterparts, the May 2017 Group of Seven gathering in Taormina, Sicily, Trump's advisors offered the other governments damage control tips. Don't be patronizing to Trump, and sprinkle in compliments of him. Quote, "It was all advice on how to handle a difficult teenager, a very sensitive, touchy teenager," end quote, Araud recalled. Quote, "So you have six adults trying not to excite him, and they are facing somebody who has no restraint and no limits. To be the adult in the room is to suffer the tantrum of the kid and not to take it seriously," end quote. The title of this book borrows Trump's own words. In January 2018, as Trump neared the end of his first year in office, a national discussion was underway about the president's fitness for office, specifically his mental acuity and psychological health. Just before sunrise on January 6, Trump tweeted that the media were, quote, "taking out the old Ronald Reagan playbook and screaming mental stability and intelligence," end quote. Quote, "Actually, throughout my life, my two greatest assets have been mental stability and being, like, really smart," end quote, he continued. Quote, "Crooked Hillary Clinton also played these cards very hard and, as everyone knows, went down in flames. I went from very successful businessman to top TV star to president of the United States on my first try. I think that would qualify as not smart, but genius, and a very stable genius at that," end quote. Trump invoked the stable genius phrase at least four additional times. At a NATO summit in July 2018, he labeled himself, quote, "a very stable genius," end quote, as he tried to dismiss a reporter's question about whether he would reverse his support for NATO after leaving the Brussels meeting. In a July 2019 morning tweet storm that covered everything from the Democratic presidential primaries to the Pledge of Allegiance, Trump wrote of himself, quote, "What you have now, so great-looking and smart, a true stable genius," end quote. On a Saturday morning in September 2019, Trump quoted himself on Twitter by writing, quote, "a very stable genius, thank you," end quote. And in October 2019, as he defended his conduct on a phone call with his Ukrainian counterpart, Trump remarked, quote, "There are those that think I'm a very stable genius, okay? I watch my words very, very closely," end quote. Critics mockingly concluded that any man who feels compelled to announce to the world that he is a stable genius is neither stable nor a genius. However, Trump's intimates offered a different interpretation. Quote, "He truly has genius characteristics," end quote, said Thomas Barrack, a longtime Trump friend and business associate who chaired his presidential inaugural. Quote, "Like all these savants, he has edges that at times people wish weren't there. He may not have the trained or staged elegance of an Obama, or the ambassadorial restraint of a Kennedy, or the soft regalness of a Reagan, but he has a kind of brilliance and charisma that is unique, rare, and captivating, although at times misunderstood. When he speaks one-on-one or to a crowd, you believe that you are the only star in his galaxy. He is a genius warrior," end quote. Many close observers of Trump saw his so-called genius as far more destabilizing. One of them was Peter Wehner, who served in the Ronald Reagan, George H.W. Bush, and George W. Bush administrations. An early and outspoken critic of Trump's, Wehner was one of the first Republicans to warn publicly about his psychological unfitness to be president. By the spring of 2019, Wehner had become truly distraught by what he was witnessing. Quote, "He is a transgressive personality, so he likes to attack and destroy and unsettle people," end quote, Wehner said. Quote, "If he sees an institution that he thinks is not doing his bidding, not protecting him like he wants, or is a threat to him, he'll go after it. The intelligence community, because they didn't tell him what he wanted to hear. The Justice Department, because it wasn't doing what he wanted to do. The North Atlantic Treaty Organization, because he doesn't think they pay enough. The press is the enemy of the people. So he doesn't have any regard for institutions, the role they play, why they're important, and he delights in tearing them down," end quote. Wehner pointed to the British philosopher and statesman Edmund Burke, who wrote in his 1790 pamphlet, Reflections on the Revolution in France, that, quote, "the rudest hand," end quote, "of any mob could annihilate an institution, but rebuilding one from the rubble would be far more difficult. Quote, "Rage and frenzy will pull down more in half an hour than prudence, deliberation, and foresight can build up in 100 years, end quote. What follows is a chronological account of Trump's vainglorious pursuit of power in his first term, one that seeks to make meaning by finding patterns in the seeming chaos. There are rages and frenzies, but also moments of courage and perseverance. The narrative is intended to reveal Trump at his most unvarnished and expose how decision-making in his administration has been driven by one man's self-centered and unthinkable logic, but a logic nonetheless. This is the story of how Trump and his advisors have scrambled to survive and tested the strength of America's democracy and its common heart as a nation.
Part 1. 1. Building Blocks. On November 9, 2016, President-elect Donald Trump began to staff his administration. Because he never truly expected to win, he was unprepared. Trump prioritized loyalty above all, and so, instinctively, he and his family knew whom to knight first: Michael Flynn. Flynn was a retired lieutenant general and had been a respected intelligence officer, yet his former colleagues had shunned him for a bill of particulars that included Islamophobic rhetoric, coziness with Russia and other foreign adversaries, and a reliance on flimsy facts and dubious assertions. None of that mattered to Trump. During the campaign, Flynn was one of the few men who had ever worn stars on their shoulders willing to promote Trump. His allegiance was so intense that he had led an anti-Hillary Clinton chant of "lock her up" at the Republican National Convention, which mortified his military and intelligence brethren, who believed he was leveraging his status as a decorated former military officer to fuel society's more dangerous elements. Yet this endeared him to Trump. Flynn made himself indispensable to Trump, whispering in his ear that he couldn't trust most intelligence officials, but could trust Flynn. He was crafty enough to ingratiate himself with Trump's family, too, including Jared Kushner, the candidate's ambitious son-in-law, who had no experience in politics or foreign affairs, yet styled himself as Trump's political strategist and interlocutor with foreign governments. The day after the election, the flattering consigliere got his reward at a transition meeting on the 26th floor of Trump Tower. Ivanka Trump, the president-elect's elder daughter, and her husband, Kushner, who together helped oversee some of the high-level appointments in the new administration, made clear to Flynn that he could choose any job he wanted. "Oh, General Flynn, how loyal you've been to my father," Ivanka said in her distinctive, breathy voice, adding something to the effect of, "What do you want to do?" Don McGahn frowned with some surprise. He had been the Trump campaign's lawyer and was now in line to become White House counsel. He had nothing personal against Flynn. He didn't really know him. But others in the room noticed McGahn's displeasure, which seemed to say, "Is this really how we're going to do this?" Some in the room could hardly believe people were being appointed to key jobs so indiscriminately and irresponsibly. As Steve Bannon, the campaign's chief executive officer, who also was joining the administration, saw it, Ivanka was the princess with the sword, just tapping Flynn on the shoulder. McGahn and Bannon, hardly allies, shared the belief that this was a recipe for missteps and, quite possibly, disaster. The haphazard and dysfunctional transition was a harbinger for the administration. Trump placed a premium on branding and image at the expense of fundamental competence. He and many of his advisors had no experience with public service, and therefore little regard for its ethics or norms. Rather than hewing to an ideological agenda, the entire operation was guided by Trump's instincts and whims. Flynn's dream was to be national security advisor. Kushner, who was envisioning for himself a West Wing role as a shadow secretary of state, interacting with foreign leaders, negotiating Middle East peace, and running point on such key relationships as China and Mexico, calculated that installing Flynn as national security advisor would create for himself the freedom to maneuver as he pleased. Just like that, Flynn's wish was granted. It would take another 8 days for his appointment to be announced, but everything was set in motion on November 9th. Nobody bothered to vet Flynn. There was no review of his tenure as a U.S. military intelligence chief in Afghanistan, which had been the subject of a misconduct investigation, nor of his time as director of the Defense Intelligence Agency, which President Obama had cut short, nor of his international consulting firm and his contracts with Kremlin-aligned companies, nor of his attendance at a 2015 Moscow gala as a guest of Russia, seated at the table of President Vladimir Putin. Flynn had used the Trump campaign as a gravy train, hoping to better his lifestyle after 33 years of relatively low military wages. At the same time he was advising candidate Trump, Flynn was working for the Turkish government and, according to federal investigators, concealing the nature of that arrangement. On Election Day, Flynn published an op-ed in The Hill, in which he trumpeted Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan's cause by comparing his political opponent Fethullah Gulen, who was living in exile in the United States, to Osama bin Laden. Flynn called for the United States to force Gulen out of the country, stunning his former colleagues in the intelligence and national security communities. Chris Christie, the New Jersey governor who had endorsed Trump and was the chairman of the presidential transition, was flabbergasted when the president-elect told him he would name Flynn his national security advisor. "You can't do that," said Christie. "First, you have to have a chief of staff in place, and let your chief of staff have input on that, because the security advisor is going to be reporting to the chief of staff. And Flynn's just the wrong choice. He's just a horrific choice." "You just don't like him," Trump replied. "Well, you're right," Christie said. "I don't like him. Do you want to know why?" "Yeah," Trump said. "Because he's going to get you in trouble," Christie replied. "Take my word for it." Trump didn't want to hear anything else about Flynn. He told Christie to go downstairs to the 14th floor, where the campaign headquarters had morphed overnight into a transition command center. Christie had a government to assemble. Later that week, Christie was canned by Trump. Technically, he was fired by Bannon, who told Christie he was acting on orders from Kushner, but Trump had allowed the termination. He was replaced as transition chairman by Vice President-elect Mike Pence. 11 years earlier, Christie had been U.S. attorney in New Jersey and had put Kushner's father, Charles, head of the family's real estate business, behind bars for tax evasion, witness tampering, and illegal campaign contributions. The case humiliated the Kushner family and left a lasting impression on young Jared. On November 10th, Trump was 230 miles south in Washington, visiting Obama at the White House. Obama was unsettled by Trump's victory, but less than 48 hours after the election, in accordance with America's tradition of peaceful transfers of power, he welcomed his successor into the Oval Office and offered him some advice. Two things the 44th president said stuck with the 45th. One, that North Korea was the biggest foreign policy challenge and security threat, and two, that he should not hire Flynn. Obama personally warned Trump against hiring Flynn because he found his judgment dubious and his motives untrustworthy. Obama had fired Flynn in 2014 from the Defense Intelligence Agency amid complaints in the agency that he lacked focus and an even temperament. Trump later recounted to aides that Obama had called Flynn a flake and a bad guy, a critique Trump dismissed. The president-elect approached the 10-week transition as a casting call for a new season of The Apprentice, the NBC reality show that had made him a household name. Day after day, Trump Tower's golden-framed revolving door on Fifth Avenue delivered politicians, business leaders, and celebrities who paraded through the lobby for their appointed visits. They came to pitch themselves for jobs in the administration or to curry favor with the president-elect or simply to get a piece of the action. It was like walking into the Jabba the Hutt bar in Star Wars, one Trump advisor said dismissively. You never knew who was going to crawl in. The president-elect loved to gin up the ratings and was quick to seize on how the presidency could benefit his personal brand and his businesses. He held job interviews and transition meetings not inside the federal office building in Washington that was provided for this purpose, but at Trump Tower, Trump National Golf Club in Bedminster, New Jersey, and Mar-a-Lago in Palm Beach, Florida. In the helter-skelter, unstructured rhythms of the transition, a trio of campaign power players jockeyed for influence: Kushner, Bannon, and Reince Priebus. Kushner had exalted status as Trump's son-in-law, while Priebus and Bannon were appointed early on as White House Chief of Staff and White House Chief Strategist, a unique arrangement in which they had co-equal footing atop the organizational chart. Trump tapped Priebus, who had been the Republican National Committee chairman, partly as a thank-you present for the foot soldiers and state-by-state organization that the RNC built for Trump to compensate for his campaign's almost non-existent ground game. Well-connected in Washington, Priebus was considered by GOP leaders to have the most capable set of hands among Trump's aides. Bannon, meanwhile, was impolitic, gruff, and unkempt. He had proven his loyalty in the trenches with Trump during the toughest stretch of the campaign. Bannon had previously run the conservative website Breitbart and pitched himself to Trump as the essential conduit to his indispensable base, which he affectionately referred to as the deplorables, a reference to Clinton's infamous gaffe about Trump's basket of deplorables, the racist, sexist, homophobic, xenophobic, Islamophobic, you name it. Priebus set about installing former RNC staffers and other trusted figures in key West Wing roles, while he, Bannon, and Pence focused on cabinet positions. They paid special attention early on to national security roles and had their eyes on Mike Pompeo to lead the CIA. Pompeo had been elected to Congress as a Kansas Republican in the Tea Party wave of 2010, and when he arrived in Washington, he quickly established himself as a hardline conservative and a sharp partisan. From his perch on the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence, Pompeo had hounded Clinton over Benghazi, making him a Breitbart favorite. Though he had known Priebus, Bannon, and Pence for years, Pompeo was an outsider to Trump's world. In fact, He had campaigned vigorously against Trump in the primaries as a Marco Rubio surrogate. During the March 5th Kansas caucuses, Pompeo had warned that Trump would be an authoritarian president who ignored our Constitution, and he urged his fellow Kansans to turn down the lights on the circus. But Pompeo was eager to join the circus now. Bannon knew that it would be hard to sell a small state congressman he regarded as a warrior's warrior as a potential CIA director to the elites he dubbed the Morning Joe crowd, given Pompeo's Benghazi bludgeoning. But Pompeo wanted the job. On November 16th, Pompeo traveled to New York to meet with the president-elect. Priebus had prepped Trump on Pompeo's credentials, and Bannon had given Pompeo a pep talk, telling him something along the lines of, "We're just going to go in. I'm going to reiterate you're number one in your class at West Point, number one in your class at Harvard Law School. You're the best guy intelligence ever had. I'm going to tee you up, and don't wait for him to say anything. You just rip. Do not wait for a question, because there won't be a question. He doesn't even know what intelligence is. Just rip." The meeting went off without a hitch. After others fluffed him up before the boss, Pompeo talked about restructuring the CIA. He and Trump chewed over problems with the Iran nuclear deal. As a West Point and Harvard Law graduate, Pompeo easily checked the credentials box. The former Army captain, beefy and hulking as he works a room, also had the imposing tough guy image Trump desired. Before the meeting concluded, Pompeo had the job. Trump shook his hand, turned to Bannon and Priebus, and said, "I love it. Let's do it." 2 days later, Pompeo was formally announced as Trump's nominee for CIA director. Pompeo would become one of the more respected members of the administration, but Trump offered him the CIA directorship based on a single interview. Trump approached staffing the administration like a casting call and sought the look, a fixation in keeping with the beauty pageants he had once run. For national security positions, he gravitated toward generals. For public-facing communication roles, he wanted attractive women. At the United Nations, he picked as his ambassador Nikki Haley, whom he typecast for the UN in part because she was a daughter of Indian-American immigrants. To Trump, one of the most important attributes for any job candidate was the ability to present well on television. "Don't forget, he's a showbiz guy," Christopher Ruddy, a Trump friend and the chief executive of Newsmax, remarked. "He likes people who present themselves very well, and he's very impressed when somebody has a background of being good on television because he thinks it's a very important medium for public policy." Ruddy added, "The look might not necessarily be somebody who should be on the cover of GQ magazine or Vanity Fair. It's more about the look and the demeanor and the swagger." On December 6th, Trump formally announced the retired Marine Corps General James Mattis as his nominee for defense secretary, playing up his rugged appearance and combat history. He told aides he was especially enamored with the nickname that Mattis privately disliked. "Mad Dog plays no games, right?" Trump told a roaring crowd as he announced Mattis's nomination at a rally in Fayetteville, North Carolina. He called a reluctant Mattis onto the stage and lauded him as "the closest thing to General George Patton that we have," referring to the legendary World War II commander played by the late George C. Scott in the 1970 biopic, one of Trump's favorite films. While Trump was taken with Mattis's physical appearance and his macho moniker, his nomination was very reassuring to the national security establishment. At least there would be a seasoned and steady set of hands at the Pentagon. When Mattis later interviewed candidates for senior staff positions at the Pentagon, he would ask, "Can you ride the brand?" What he really meant was, "Can you support Trump, warts and all?" He knew this would be a controversial presidency. The transition's official vetting process varied from minimal to non-existent, depending on the candidate. Most important in researching one's background was a review of news articles and social media accounts to see whether he or she had ever said anything derogatory about Trump. One senior Trump advisor recalled, "People filled in paperwork on the airplane on their way down to the inauguration. Well, they might as well have. They didn't think about transition until literally the day they started the job." In hockey, this official added, "You can lose a knee playing with a lot of inexperienced people. That's how this has felt." Behind the scenes, Rick Gates, who had worked on the campaign as Chairman Paul Manafort's deputy, was putting together the inauguration. Gates and Manafort were longtime lobbying partners, specializing in representing foreign governments in shady plots. And when Manafort was fired from the campaign in August 2016, Trump figured his number two would leave with him. Trump strongly disliked and distrusted Gates, due in part to a toxic reaction he had to a poll Gates had commissioned. Trump didn't like the survey's results, which rated his popularity as low, and felt Gates was cheating the campaign by paying the pollster for such junk. "Gates gives me the creeps," Trump told some associates. But Gates had a powerful champion in Thomas Barrack, who chaired the presidential inaugural committee. Trump had no idea Gates was quietly helping Barrack direct the inaugural festivities until one night, sometime in the middle of the transition, when the president-elect overheard his wife, Melania, talking about him. At the same time, Johnny McEntee, 26, Trump's personal assistant and body man, had arrived at the Trump's penthouse to bring the president-elect a sub sandwich for dinner. In the living room, Melania and Stephanie Winston Wolkoff, a friend of the incoming First Lady's who was helping plan inaugural events, were sitting on a sofa talking about inauguration plans. Trump walked into the room to get his sandwich from McEntee, just as he heard Melania say the name Rick. "Rick? Rick who?" Trump asked his wife. "Rick Gates," she said. Trump lost it. He started yelling. "What the fuck are you doing?" he asked. Trump decided to fire Gates on the spot and turned to McEntee and said, "Johnny, get with Melania. You're the executive director." By all accounts, McEntee was an excellent body man. Since joining the campaign before the primaries, he had spent most of his waking hours at Trump's side. He looked up to the boss, was loyal to the family, and did not leak to reporters. McEntee had Hollywood good looks, just the kind of image Trump sought to project. He was athletic, too, having played quarterback for the University of Connecticut Huskies and even becoming something of a YouTube sensation for a viral video of football trick shots. McEntee, however, had precisely zero experience in running a presidential inaugural. This was a $107 million operation, not merely a grand celebration of Trump's election, but also a projection to the nation of the new president's values and goals for governing. Within a few hours after Barrack persuaded Trump to reverse his snap decision and simply put up with Gates for a little longer, McEntee was back to being the body guy and would move with Trump to Washington. The president-elect completely disregarded government ethics and the law. Ivanka and Kushner were eager to leave their mark on Washington and to serve in the West Wing, a role they thought would burnish the personal brands they had so carefully cultivated back in New York. Some Trump advisors saw this as a risky proposition, certain to invite cries of nepotism and create an untenable working environment. Yet even before the inauguration, no one felt they could tell the kids, among some West Wing colleagues, Ivanka and Kushner were called just that, the kids. No. There are some things in life, when you shoot, you better kill. I knew that this was not a winning effort to stop the kids from coming into the West Wing, recalled one of their colleagues. They were dead set on coming, and there was nothing anyone was going to do about it. And I think everyone understood that. White House lawyers were concerned that Ivanka's business interests created potentially huge ethical quagmires. In addition to her clothing company, she was involved in the Trump International Hotel in Washington, which could easily become a direct conflict with her White House role. The president had the broad authority to name his relatives to join the White House staff. Anti-nepotism laws barred a president only from appointing family members to agency jobs, according to a ruling from the Justice Department's Office of Legal Counsel. Ivanka was envisioning a norm-breaking role for herself. She wanted special treatment and sought to be immune from all of the cumbersome rules for government jobs, which she thought she could achieve by becoming an informal volunteer advisor. Even Trump had mixed feelings about whether it was a good idea for his daughter and son-in-law to follow him into the city he derided as a swamp. "Why would you want to kill yourself and come to Washington, D.C., and get shot up by all these media killers?" Trump wondered aloud to some of his advisors. But Trump couldn't say no to the kids either. He wanted family around. As the inauguration neared, Trump did not fully trust all of the aides he was hiring. He did not know whether they were coming to work for him as Trump devotees or whether he was simply their means to a job in the White House, the ultimate resume line for any political operative. His suspicions regularly burst into the open, including one evening shortly before Christmas at Mar-a-Lago, Trump's private club in Palm Beach. On December 19th, the day the Electoral College electors were certified, officially affirming Trump's victory, the president-elect celebrated over dinner with seven of his top aides. Priebus, Bannon, Deputy Campaign Manager Dave Bossy, Communications Advisor Hope Hicks, Senior Policy Advisor Stephen Miller, Social Media Director Dan Scavino, and Priebus's Deputy Katie Walsh. The eight of them sat around the table, and when the conversation turned to personnel matters, Trump impressed upon his team the importance of loyalty. As they ticked through candidates for various jobs, the president-elect repeatedly asked, "Is he loyal? Is she loyal?" Trump spent the week between Christmas and New Year's at Mar-a-Lago, accompanied by a slimmed-down cadre of aides. The morning of December 29th, as the president-elect enjoyed some golf at one of his nearby courses, CNN turned to a breaking story. White House announces retaliation against Russia. The Obama administration had decided to punish Russia for interfering in the 2016 election, shuttering two Russian compounds in the United States and ejecting 35 diplomats suspected of spying. Trump was angry when he learned the news. He felt it was one thing for Clinton's advisors and allies to accuse Russia of meddling in the election. He could just accuse the Democrats of sour grapes. But retaliatory action against Russia by the U.S. government effectively confirmed that Russia had actually interfered in the election. And that, Trump believed, raised doubts about his own victory. "They're trying to delegitimize your presidency right now," Bannon told the president. Trump was piqued that the Obama administration was sticking his incoming team with an aggressive slap at Russia, a significant foreign policy move, without so much as consulting him. The day before in Washington, Obama had signed the sanctions order with plans to announce it the next day. But a few news outlets reported on the evening of December 28th that some retaliation against Russia was expected soon. Also that evening, Russian Ambassador Sergei Kislyak was given a heads up on the sanctions by the State Department. Flustered and upset, he reached out to the Trump team. Kislyak texted Flynn on December 28th. "Can you kindly call me back at your convenience?" Flynn was spending the holiday week with his wife at a resort in the Dominican Republic. Reception there was spotty, so he did not see the ambassador's text until the next day, around the time the Obama administration had announced the sanctions. Before Flynn called Kislyak back, he wanted to check with the transition team in Mar-a-Lago. He talked for about 20 minutes with his deputy, K.T. McFarland, who was at Trump's Palm Beach Club with the president-elect. Flynn and McFarland went over the Obama administration's punitive shot and agreed it could hurt Trump's intended goals of cultivating a better relationship with Putin. McFarland shared with Flynn the consensus among the team at Mar-a-Lago. They hoped Russia would not ratchet up the aggression in responding to Obama's move. Immediately after hanging up with McFarland, Flynn dialed Kislyak and asked that the Kremlin not get into a tit-for-tat. Flynn assured the ambassador that the incoming administration would likely revisit sanctions and possibly rescind them. He raised the possibility that he could arrange a meeting with Trump later on, once they were all in the White House. By communicating about U.S. policy with Kislyak before Trump took office, Flynn was undermining the current administration and breaking the standards of diplomacy. His communications were instantly picked up and stored by the massive listening apparatus of the National Security Agency, which routinely surveils prominent government officials and helps the FBI monitor suspected spies who work for hostile foreign powers. Despite the high drama of the Russian compounds being evacuated, Putin's reaction the next day, December 30th, was unexpectedly calm. "We will not create any problems for U.S. diplomats," Putin said. "It is regrettable that the Obama administration is ending its term in this manner. Nevertheless, I offer my New Year greetings to President Obama and his family," he said. "My season's greetings also to President-elect Donald Trump and the American people." Putin's tone surprised CIA Director John Brennan and Director of National Intelligence James R. Clapper. At that time, neither of them knew about Flynn's secret assurances to and request of Kislyak. Some U.S. officials wondered if Putin was just toying with the Americans. Yet, he never pounced. That same afternoon, Trump startled the outgoing Obama team with this tweet: "Great move on delay by V. Putin. I always knew he was very smart." On January 6th, Brennan, Clapper, FBI Director James Comey, and National Security Agency Director Michael Rogers traveled to New York to brief Trump, Pence, and their top advisors about the extensive Russian campaign to influence the 2016 election in Trump's favor, and sow discord through cyber attacks and social media infiltration. During this infamous briefing at Trump Tower, the president-elect rejected what did not confirm his view. This was not how an incoming commander-in-chief was meant to act. As the 90-minute meeting wrapped up, Comey and Trump cleared the room to speak alone. The FBI director brought up a salacious dossier, a widely circulated collection of intelligence reports written by the former British spy Christopher Steele. Comey noted that it alleged that Russians had filmed Trump interacting with prostitutes in Moscow in 2013. Trump immediately denied the allegations, snorting, "There were no prostitutes," and arguing that he wasn't the kind of man who needed to go there. Trump had praised Comey for having reopened the Hillary Clinton email investigation in the final stretch of the 2016 campaign, but now wondered whose team Comey was really on. Trump's distrust of the intelligence community only grew when, shortly after the Trump Tower meeting, The agencies published their report detailing Russia's election interference campaign. This infuriated Trump. He concluded that the national security establishment would never respect him and was determined to sabotage his presidency. There were three core questions facing U.S. intelligence officials about Russia's role in the 2016 election. First, did the Russian government itself interfere? The overwhelming evidence said yes. Next, did Russia try to help Trump win? Much of the evidence suggested yes. Finally, did Russia's efforts change the election result? Intelligence leaders argued they lacked the ability to say definitively. But Trump believed that acknowledging Russian intervention effectively tainted his victory. In the days following the January 6th intelligence briefing, Priebus, Kushner, and other advisors pleaded with Trump to publicly acknowledge the unanimous conclusion the spy chiefs had presented to him. They held impromptu interventions in his 26th-floor office in which they tried to convince him that he could affirm the validity of the intelligence without invalidating or even diminishing his win. This was part of the normalization process, one advisor explained. There was a big effort to get him to be a standard president. But Trump dug in. Each time his advisors pushed him to accept the intelligence, he grew more agitated. He railed that the intelligence community's leaders were deceitful and could not be trusted. "I can't trust anybody," the president-elect said. On that point, he was seconded by Bannon, who said of the Russia report, "It's all gobbledygook." The president-elect said he believed admitting that the Kremlin had hacked Democratic emails would be a trap. On January 11th, just 9 days before the inauguration, Trump held a news conference in the pink-marbled lobby of Trump Tower. His advisors pleaded with him once more to accept the intelligence community's assessment, and he begrudgingly complied. "As far as hacking, I think it was Russia," Trump told reporters. "But I think we also get hacked by other countries and other people." Yet Trump also accused the intelligence agencies, without evidence, of leaking the Steele dossier to BuzzFeed, which had published the salacious material on January 10th. "That's something that Nazi Germany would have done and did do," he said. "I think it's a disgrace that information that was false and fake and never happened got released to the public." Soon after the news conference ended, however, Trump told his aides that he regretted accepting the findings about Russian hacking. "It's not me," he told his aides. "It wasn't right."